All right, we're with the great Bart DeSmet, Bart J.F. DeSmet.
Yes.
Once again, great to see you, man.
Thank you. It's not been that long.
So, it hasn't lasted. In fact, we were in this room talking about RxJS, which is actually a great conversation with Matthew.
Exactly, yes.
Now, RxV2.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations, first of all. I noticed, you know, a Niner saw it and didn't get to do this announcement.
Yeah, they found it, like, you know, just like 3 hours after we put it on the download center.
Come on, Felix, man. Ruin the surprise, dude.
Felix 9, yeah.
But tell me about what are some of the big changes. So today you're going to take us through and kind of geek out pretty deeply about what's new.
White boarding. I would say there are 5 themes to this release. It's quite a bit. First of all, support for .NET 4.5, task of the async await, all of those things. And we talked a little bit about that last time, or like a couple of times ago. Secondly, support for Windows 8 Consumer Preview and .NET 4.5 beta, so you can actually use, you know, build Metro-style apps using Rx, like it's in there. I will talk in more detail about the 5 topics in just a moment, right? Third, we've been doing a lot of work on performance, and maybe we should talk a lot about that, because it's really tremendous results. Like, you know, on the average, a factor 4 for the pipeline.
Wow.
Some producers are, like, a ton faster.
Nice.
By doing some new scheduler tricks and stuff. And reducing object allocations and all of those things. Like, we can do millions of messages a second, so that's really, really amazing. Actually, it's close to the, you know, speed of invoking delegates. Like, you know, every operator should really be just one invocation. In the past, we had many invocations to go from one operator to another.
Okay.
The handover between the observers had a lot of plumbing with it to ensure safety and stuff, and we could take away some of that. So that's the performance thing. We did some new operators as well, so like some extensions to delay, throttle, to actually have higher order notions of time. Like historically, like for a window, for example, we had time spans and we had counts and all of those things, and we generalized those in V1 to say a duration is really like a selector function that takes in a value and says how long the value takes, and then you have an iObservable of duration, and when that thing fires, that's the end of the time frame. So now delay, throttle, timeout have those operator overloads as well. So you can actually, for example, you can delay birthday notifications based on the birthday in a person object. Like you could do a selector function that says this is the birthday, let's do an observable timer for every person that indicates when the birthday happens. And then, you know, the notification is delayed till the birthday happens. And then fifth and last, we actually sort of aligned with the first two. We're introducing support for portable library for Rx.
Nice.
And actually, I can talk a lot about that because we had to do significant refactoring of the API service to make it work.
So let's, to be clear, that means you can use Rx with the .NET portable library.
Exactly. Yeah. Limited to .NET 4.5, .NET 4.5 Metro. Maybe we'll be able to add .NET 4 to it.
Okay.
Going forward, we'll add next releases of Windows Phone to it as well, but today we can't unify it with the Windows Phone 7 release because the interfaces, iObserver and iObserver of T, live in a different assembly, and that makes it hard to unify. Now going forward, they will live in the same place in MS Core Lib, like we've been engaging with the Windows Phone forks for the next releases to make sure things are in the same spots, and then we'll be able to sort of extend our reach of portability. So it's very limited at this point, but it will grow over time. So we did the hard work this time, took the hit now, even though it's only portable between 4.5 desktop and 4.5 Metro. Mm-hmm. But going forward, we'll get more. So.
Okay.
So maybe we should do some whiteboarding.
It's been too long, Bart.
It's been too long.
So let's do it.
Yeah, okay. I'll start with the portability, because the thing that that people will see first when they try to include references to our assemblies.
Great.
So if you look at the existing layer diagram of Rx, we have quite a few assemblies in there. And the answer to portability is add more, like split some things up. So let's actually draw the current situation and then see what we refactored in there. So the current situation is really like this. At the very bottom of our stack, we have the BCL and the CLR. And we use that for a number of things, of course, like, you know, the iObservable of T interface, you know, threading, all sorts of things. Good? Now, on top of that, in RxV1, we actually migrated some of the stuff that we had in pre-releases into one big assembly called system.reactive. So that's this guy, and I will call it quite big because it contains a number of layers internally itself. So I will call this system dot react. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now looking into that box a little bit more, there are like, I would say, three layers to it. At the very bottom, you have some additional interfaces. And depending on the platform you're using, those interfaces include iObservable of T. Like in .NET 3.5, Silverlight, Windows Phone, like not on Windows Phone, but in the other ones, we don't have iObservable of T in the BCL CLR yet, so they live in here.
Okay.
We also have Subject, iScheduler, those kind of things. So let's just put one sample here, like iScheduler. Okay? Now on top of that, we sort of have a little layer, let's put it like this, that actually is our, what I would call the virtual machine of Rx, which is our scheduler infrastructure.
Mm.
So that's the thing where if you say, please pump me a timer, that's the thing that does it. That says like, I will run that action in 5 seconds from now, that kind of stuff. So those are the schedulers. And then on top of that, we have a library for link, which lives in systemreactive.link, and the schedulers live in systemreactive concurrency, that actually compiles things into calls on the schedulers.
Mm.
So when you write a query over here, it compiles into, if you will, it materializes itself as a sequence or a chain of observers that push the messages forward. And at the very roots of those things, or time-based operations in the middle, schedulers come in to do the work. Like, for example, delay a message means queue it up and then dequeue it at a later point in time. And so this is actually the separation you also see for database systems in general, right? In database systems, you have something like the SQL OS, or like the storage engine and all of those things, and on top of that, you have the relational algebra and the query processor. Mm-hmm. Like, we have a very similar interface between the two. It's our schedulers. So that's what System Reactive does.
Nice.
Now, on top of that, we build a couple more things. I'll actually draw it as boxes like this now. We have WinForms support over here. We have Windows.threading. So they're prefixed with System.reactive, and that's Windows Forms, that's Windows Threading. So Windows Threading exists for WPF, Silverlight, Windows Phone 7. So we have a different assembly for all those platforms that includes support for the dispatcher,
okay,
which lives in different places on those platforms, but essentially does the same. If you include those guys, you can simply do something like observe on. You say, I have a timer setting somewhere, I want to observe it on the UI, you do observe on, specify the Windows Forms control, do observe on dispatcher, specify the dispatcher, that kind of stuff. So pretty simple. Now, next to that, we also have Microsoft Reactive Testing. I'll just say testing here, which uses the VS quality tools, the unit testing projects, to do reactive tests.
Okay.
So that's our test scheduler infrastructure. And finally, we have over here, and let me actually draw it in red, because I actually have a reason to draw it in red. That thing is providers, system reactive providers, which is our Ike observable stuff. And actually, lately, I've seen some cool uses of Ike observable for things I didn't anticipate. So people are starting to play with that quite a bit, actually.
Nice.
So they're taking expression trees and compiling them to a mini-language that runs on the flash chip of an embedded device.
Nice.
So you write your query, and it basically translates in a little bit of bytecode, sends it to the device, and runs the query over there very efficiently. So beautiful use of that technology.
Wow. I was wondering if anyone was ever going to use that.
Oh, yes. And actually, we see some other teams within this organization using it.
Awesome.
I can't talk about that yet, but like in a future product, you will see our expression trees used quite a bit.
Great.
So that's what we have here in V1.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in V1, you should really look at this whole picture and multiply it by, now I have to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like times 5. Because you have .NET 3.5, .NET 4, Silverlight 4, Silverlight 5, Windows Phone 7. We support all those platforms. So we needed to have this whole same stack 5 times. So you have like 5 times 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's 25 assemblies in the SDK. Add to that Windows 8 Metro, like that would be another 5. And that's not what we want. Well, no WinForms there, but like, mm-hmm. You know, so that's not really sustainable in the long run. So for portability, we had to look at what's in here that's portable. And so the portable things are actually system reactive largely. Providers are portable as well. But there are a couple of things in here that are not portable. So for example, in here, We have a scheduler called the new thread scheduler. Well, you can't do new thread on Windows 8 Metro Star apps. The threading API is not available, so that's not really portable. At some points, those schedulers, like the immediate scheduler, have to do something like thread.sleep. Not portable either. So there are a couple of things in here, in the core of Rx, that are not portable. So we had to do something about that. And so what we're doing is, first of all, we're slicing this thing up in three different assemblies. So actually where those cutoff lines are here are the three different assemblies. So actually let me draw the diagram next to it, or I could mutate the current diagram. What should we do? Should you mutate it? I will try.
I think so.
I'll try to mutate it. So what we did is, first of all, I'll actually rename this guy on the top here to System Reactive Link. Okay? And draw a red line over here. So that's one box that we have sitting here now. And that's our query engine. Okay?
Okay.
Underneath we have System Reactive Core. System RX, I will abbreviate it Core, which contains schedulers. Okay? And then at the very bottom, we have System Reactive Interfaces. System.rx, just an abbreviation, interfaces. So that guy, at the very bottom, will have a stable version number 2000. Maybe a little revision over here.
Okay.
But that will be stable throughout 2.0. We won't add new interfaces here, meaning people can take a dependency on that and won't have to recompile if you do 2.1 or something. So that's the first thing.
Great.
Secondly, System Reactive Core. So that's a portable library. It's portable for .NET 4, 4.5, and 4.5 Metro. Maximal portable, because it relies on iObservLoft and in the other platforms they don't live in the same places. Ultimately, iObservLoft will live in the same place everywhere. System RX Core, well, we still have that black box in there for new threading. Mm-hmm. What do we do with that guy? So for that guy to actually work, you should realize that the problem is this, the threading. It's not available everywhere. So what do we do? If you look at the framework itself has two things to it now. Has the portable subset and the non-portable subset. So I will say NP over here, that's non-portable, platform specific. And on top of that guy, we build an extra assembly called System Reactive Platform Services. And that has a couple of roles, and I will talk about it in just a second. So you can get rid of that stuff over here. And this guy sort of relies on that one to get additional schedulers. I'll explain that in just a second. We have System Reactive Link on top. Now, at the same time, we've brought some of those guys a little bit down. What do I mean with that? Let me actually make a little bit of place here. That's System RX Link on the top, right? We talked about that one. System RX Link. It's really linked to events, right? And really, I will cut it off over here and relayer things this way. So those assemblies, the Windows Forms guy and the Windows Threading guy, they don't really need the query engine to synchronize with the UI thread. The only thing they need is schedulers. So those guys are sitting lower, meaning if something in the framework exposes an iObservable, and we are investigating certain places with teams, so that will be the case, then in order to put those things on the UI, you don't really need link for that. You can just bind them to the UI by just having dependency on System Reactive Core. So you don't need to deploy the whole thing. So that's going down a little bit in the stack. And so here we have link support. So what does this platform services thing do? Well, platform services contains the schedulers that are not portable. So schedulers that don't live in the intersection between 4.5, 4.5 Metro, like NewThread and those kind of things. But it does a second thing as well. It actually acts as what I call an enlightenment module. That's misspelled a little, I think. Whatever. So the enlightenment module is basically well known by System Reactive Core over here. And what it does is this guy tries to locate this guy. It's not portable, this guy.
Okay.
It's for different platforms, there's a different one. So the red ones over here, that's hence my color scheme, the red ones are portable. So you have those, and those are platform specific. They build on top of the portable guys. And so this platform services thing contains, for example, if you are on desktop CLR, it contains a NewThread scheduler, it contains the event loop scheduler, things that you don't have in different subsets of the platform. But it also contains enlightenment facilities that this guy can look for. So here's an example. In this guy, we need to do a portable way of, for example, running a timer or doing a thread.sleep. There is no portable way of doing that. So there is one way that you can, for example, do something time-based, because we need to have default schedulers for certain things that are platform independent. Like, the way to do a timer is something like this. You do thread, not thread, task, dot delay of, say, 5 seconds, and then you await that guy, and then you run the thing that then your timer has to fire. That's a way of doing a timer that expires in 5 seconds, right? But if you look at task.delay, which lives in the portable subset, it's not that efficient. It's good for a lot of things, but if you do like task.delay 1 millisecond, something you might well do in Rx, like because we are at the same time doing the performance, that we can do millions of messages a second. Like, if you want to do something like this, what do you have here? You have one task object allocation per thing, and underneath it allocates a system threading timer. That's not available in the portable library subset. So in this scheduler facility over here, we do those default things. Task.delay is the best thing we can do in the portable subset. But once you install that guy, the enlightenment module, it's a little bit like the guest components in a virtual machine like Hyper-V. If you have Windows XP running there, you install the integration components, it goes quicker. Like, because that guy gets enlightened by where it's running. And so this guy figures out, oh, I have an enlightenment module sitting there. I can do a better way at doing timers. And that guy, if you're on the Metro subset, it will use the dispatcher timer of Windows Metro, or the ThreadPool timer that they have. If you are using ThreadPool facilities in Rx, it will use the WinRT ThreadPool. If you're on the CLR, like if you're actually running the desktop CLR, we'll use the CLR ThreadPool. We'll use the system.threading timer namespace, all of those things. So depending where you are, you have a different enlightenment module that can do something about the situation here. You can run without that thing, still runs, just less efficient, because it has to go for commonalities between the platforms, which typically are abstractions of lower-level things that are not portable.
Okay.
So that's actually how all of this works.
Nice.
Now, the beauty is you don't have to know anything about this if you use Rx. So if you actually use NuGet, for example, and you say, include, please, Rx main, if you include Rx main, you get all of this. And depending on the platform, you will always get the same portable guys. You will get a platform-specific enlightenment module. So if you do that in a Metro thing, you will get a different guy here. If you do it in Silverlight, you will get a different guy there. Like, well, not in Silverlight because it's not portable. It doesn't use the portable guys at this point. But so that's what you do.
Great.
Windows Threading over here now has Windows 8 Core Dispatcher support, Metro support. So it's the same name. We did have System Reactive Windows Runtime at some point. We can merge that with this guy. And the UI facilities will live in System Windows Threading or System Reactive Windows Threading. One more thing is if you are doing a Metro app and you're not using NuGet for whatever reason, you can actually right-click on the Add Reference dialog. And the Add Reference dialog for Metro projects has two things. It has the framework extensions. So there you can find System Reactive Link, System Reactive Core, System Reactive Interface, System Reactive Platform Services, System Reactive Windows Threading. But you can also right-click and go to the Extension SDK tab. And there you can simply put a checkbox in front of Reactive Extensions and we'll include everything.
Nice.
So that's a bundle of framework components. They've done that because the framework is refactored and it contains like 80 assemblies or something. Like, you don't want to include like, oh, system reactor, or system.core.link, system.core.link.expression, system.reflection.emit, system.reflection.emit.lightweight, or whatever. Like, it's so many assemblies that they made that much easier in the IDE.
Great.
So that's the whole portability story. For the beta,
yes,
those guys exist as portable ones, but the non-portable extensions on top of that, like 4.5 Metro, are not yet layered on top of them, because we still have some work to do. So if people want to try and play with those portable libraries, they can do it manually. You will have to remove some assembly references and put the other ones in place, just for the beta. Post-beta will actually fix that. But so people can start playing with it, create portable libraries. It's a little hard to use from VS at this point, but in the next update to our beta, we'll actually have the layering done properly.
Okay.
So today you can actually include like Rx main in a .NET 4.5 project, you will get the non-portable versions of those three guys. But then you can take out the non-portable ones and swap in the portable guys. And then you will be using the portable subset.
Okay.
Ultimately, when you include RX main from NuGet, you will get the portable layers at the bottom and the non-portable ones at the top. So it's just a matter of time. Like, we want to give people something that they can start playing with, show that portable library for RX is real, and ultimately we'll actually relay everything on top of it.
Awesome.
So it's a transition step, but we're getting there.
Great. Well, it's actually a hard problem.
It's quite a bit of work, yes.
Yes,
like, you know, creating additional projects and finding all those dependencies, and there are more dependencies than you expect at first. Like, for example, we're using exception dispatch info on .NET 4.5 to make our exception handling nicer, that you get complete call stacks. So that's great, but that only exists in 4.5 Metro. That's one of the reasons we said portability. We could try to include .NET 4.0, but it gets a lot hairier over here, and we need more enlightenment services to figure out, can you do something better about retrieving this exception? On 4.5, it would say, yes, I know how to do that. On 4.0, it would say, no, I don't know, just retrieve that thing. Like, we could do more of that and gain .NET 4 in this equation, but it adds a lot of, like, non-optimal things over here that are much better in 4.5. So we rather look forward and say, like, 4.5 and beyond is what we will make portable, and the older platforms you will still have separate downloads for, rather than trying to get an old platform to go with it just for the next few months or few years, and then ultimately have done something suboptimal over here. So we rather look towards the future.
Understood.
In a better position.
But I mean, that brings up a good point. I mean, the code that has been, let's say you invested a lot of time in writing code in the current version.
Yes.
The code itself can be moved over to the new world.
Exactly.
A modest number of changes, perhaps.
Yes.
So it's not that dramatic
of
a requirement.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But that's great work. And of course, you did this work part.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay. In fact, you do most of the work.
I do, actually.
In RX.
Yeah, most of the
Wes has now moved along, and
yes, yeah.
People know that.
Matthew is doing RxJS.
Matthew is the RxJS man.
Now, the RxNet wizard at this point.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
In terms of all the great work you've done in V2, and I don't believe we talked about this with Matthew.
Yes.
Did that translate to RxJS?
Yep.
Currently shipping?
Shipping in hopefully next week, actually. Matthew
nice.
Did all the porting work now.
Nice, Matthew.
It's a different set of things, of
course. Oh, of
course. We did a lot of work for portability and performance work. He's focused on the features that we're adding.
Yes.
Like, I've added WinRT support. I've added things like support for task of T. Those things do not really exist in exactly the same form in JavaScript.
No.
You can do things with promises and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at interop with things like WinJS and all of those things, which are platform-specific, but then in the JS world. But the work for, like, portable library and those things, of course, like, much more work on my side, less work on his, and vice versa. There will be cases where he has more work than I have.
Yes, so, like, maybe perhaps in the performance area.
Exactly.
There is no threading in JavaScript.
That's true.
Okay, so thank you. Let's move on to your next exercise.
Yes, let's say a few things about the new operators we have.
Great.
To do things with async in a nicer way.
I'm surprised it's taking you so long to get to operators, man.
Oh, yes.
Your operator, man.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, and you're the operator of the video in this case, so I can compliment you.
Well, RX is, you know, it's all about operators.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
So what do we have in terms of await support? I already talked about that briefly before. Let's just sketch one little example here.
Okay.
Say that you have a task of T, and you want to time it out. Yeah, you can do that. Like, you know, say you do have some async API, like download web client or something. Download string. So I can say something today like, you know, var HTML equals await, and of course this has to be in an async method, so I will omit that detail.
Can you write a little bigger?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Sorry.
That's
no.
actually, no problem.
Sound like I have, yeah, there you go.
Var HTML.
Nice.
Equals await, which really should be in blue. I'm not doing syntax highlighting here.
No worries.
And let me just abbreviate it like, you know, WC for web client dot download string async. It's really called download string task async because we already had download string async for the old event-based pattern.
Okay.
Okay. So you have that guy, and now you want to time it out. That's not that easy. Like, if you want to time it out, there are ways of doing it. You can say something like, I'm not going to await it yet. I'm going to do something like task.whenany, passing in this guy as the first argument. So that's sitting over here now. Comma, task.delay of, say, 5 seconds. If the web server doesn't come back in 5 seconds, we have an issue. So you do this when anything. It's a little bit like wait handle.waitAll or wait for multiple objects EX in Win32. Like, it's very similar, but it's non-blocking. Mm. And so what you would do with this whole thing is you would await it. You would say, await that guy. And then when this await completes, it will tell you which of the two tasks has completed. So now you can do an equality check to see whether it's this guy or that guy. Mm. Which means I have to lift this thing into a variable so that I can do a comparison to it. So you have to write a lot of code, like, if this whole thing, and now I know it's a timeout, then I can render a timeout message. And I haven't even canceled this guy in doing all of that stuff. So that's the imperative way of doing it. It's doable now. Like, with classic asynchrony, very hard to do. This is great. Like, await something and you just get it back. Absolutely fantastic. Now, we can make that light up using Rx. That's the beauty. So in Rx now, you can say, instead of doing all this wait any task delay stuff, you could say something like, await web client download string async dot to observable, which is a task that's now turned into an observable, which will contain one value or an exception. And then on there, you can use Rx. You can say timeout with a time span of 5 seconds. Done.
Nice.
What happens with that thing is, when you await the observable, we subscribe to it, the subscription bubbles up to two observable, listens to the task of T. If the task of T throws an exception, it bubbles out, and it comes out of the await, and you can put a try-catch block around this, you can still catch the web exception. That's fantastic. If this thing doesn't come back, or if this thing comes back with a value, the HTML, it just comes out to on next through the timeout, and the await bubbles it out. So that's also great. You get the HTML in the successful case. If there is a timeout, what this guy does is, when you subscribe to it, it starts a timer of 5 seconds. If after 5 seconds an exception, or after 5 seconds a timeout occurs, it unsubscribes from that guy, and it propagates a timeout exception down, which will come out of the await. So now you can put a try catch around the await to catch the timeout exception, which is created by this guy. So that's all you can do with the await. Convert a task to an observable, compose using Rx, you could do a select, you could do a delay, you could do everything. Of course, it's a single value stream, so multi-value operations don't quite make sense in that world, but you can do a lot of things still where Rx really shines, this functional composition. And so it goes even further than that. If you would have an operation that's cancelable, say you have an async method setting somewhere, right? Instead of doing this download thing, I have something like this. I have an async method, async task of int, let me call it x, right? Mm-hmm. And it takes in some arguments, as well as a cancellation token, okay? CT. And then it does some stuff internally, right? Using await, using all of that fancy stuff. Like, what I can do now is, instead of writing this to observable thing, I can also write the following little bridge code. I can say observable dot from async, and then cancellation token goes to x of whatever the arguments are, comma cancellation token. What this gives me back for x's is actually an iObservable of int. But the cancellation token is wired up. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. If you subscribe to that guy, it calls this lambda. So this method here, this async method, doesn't start earlier than the subscription. In fact, every time you subscribe, this method executes. So this could be like download a file or something, but like every time with a different parameter, you can abstract it away. So every time you subscribe, this guy executes. But if you unsubscribe from that guy, if you dispose the subscription, it sets the cancellation token. So this guy can actually do deep cancellation all the way in the framework to stop the operation when you unsubscribe. Which means if on access you do timeout of 5 seconds, what happens if a timeout occurs? We unsubscribe from the source, which triggers the cancellation to go all the way down, and we bubble out a timeout exception. So in other words, you have deep cancellation and you have this compositional nature.
Nice.
So observable from async is one of the new guys in town for this kind of bridging. So, and no messing with, you know, the cancellation tokens. Here it's a natural thing to pass them down. In Rx, they flow out. Like, you get an iDisposable back. You don't pass in a cancellation thing. You do the opposite thing. So that's what you use this thing for now.
Great.
And we have other operators as well, like defer async, which takes in a factory method. You can make it an async.
Defer async?
Defer async.
Okay.
Yeah, so defer is observable. Defer takes in a function returning an iObservable.
Okay.
And when you subscribe, it calls that factory function. So it delays the execution or defers the execution of the factory that will obtain the sequence till the point you subscribe.
Oh.
So you can do some side effects there. But that side effect might be, I need to await a file stream or something. Now you can write just something like this. You can say observable dot defer async. And now I can say async nothing goes to, or async with a cancellation token, we have an overload, goes to, and do whatever thing you want to do in the lambda using async and await. So you can say await, like I could do this, for example, await task.delay 5 seconds, and then return observable.timer of 1 second or something. What will happen if I subscribe to that guy, we start running this async method. It hits an await, it sleeps for 5 seconds, and after 5 seconds it returns observable timer. At that point we'll subscribe to that guy. So this is like a timer that waits 5 seconds before it starts and then it starts ticking. Of course this might be something else, await web client to download something.
Sure.
Or whatever, and then parameterize the other thing with the result. Like if this thing would return X, I could feed the X over here, of course. It's the beauty of async, you can just write linear code in here.
Yeah.
We have the same for using async. So using async, if you can asynchronously obtain a resource, like a file stream, you can just write an async resource obtaining function that returns my disposable resource, and when we unsubscribe, we'll make sure that the resource goes away as well. But if we haven't gotten the resource yet, because it happens asynchronously, we'll try to cancel the getting the resource in the first place. So like we sort of do the best thing we can to get the cancellation going as deep as possible, as quickly as possible. But if we got the resource back, then we'll do our due diligence to actually dispose it at the point we need to. But so like using async, defer async, from async, create async, are overloads we have now that take in those async lambdas.
Okay.
Or async methods if you want to make them anonymous as opposed to anonymous. So that's the whole async features.
Great.
There's more, actually, but we have a huge blog post coming up by the end of this week.
Okay.
And there will be a lot of stuff in there. Like
I'm
you
sure.
can also write schedules using async now.
Cool.
So that's also pretty nice. You can await a scheduler to sleep for 5 seconds and just pump a little loop and say await 5 seconds and then do the next iteration.
So you really, so, you guys really, really integrated the new C#.
Yes.
And VB.NET.
Exactly.
Syntax into this.
Yeah,
world.
All the way through. Yes.
Very nice.
Everywhere it makes sense, you know, we have async support. Because the two are very complementary.
Yes.
Right? Like, async is about single value asynchronous computations. We are about streaming computations.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, a single value asynchronous thing is like a special kind of stream. It just happens to only contain one element. There's no point you can't bridge those too easily.
Absolutely.
And so we're doing the same with iasync operation of T and WinRT. We also have conversions for those guys.
Now, you didn't do this just because you are a pretty much an amazing programmer, an uber kind of geek. You did it because it makes sense.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You did it because it actually made your life easier writing async code using await.
Definitely, yes. Yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Exactly.
A lot of times people are going to...
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's definitely you would love to be on the cutting edge and experimenting with things.
Oh, yes.
I can see why
but
this
like,
made
like
your life
this
easier.
All makes sense. Like, you know, observable from async with a cancellation, you subscribe to it, and we make sure we can cancel if you do dispose. Like, it just makes sense to wire those things up because they're different things that are the same underneath, really, or they have.
But
the
in
same
your
concept.
Implementation,
yeah. mm-hmm.
which of course I won't see or a user will see,
mm-hmm.
you used a wait.
Actually, at this point, not. We just to continue with kind of things.
Okay.
But you know, we could actually use it for a number of those things. Yes. Okay. The thing is, like the compiler, we also need to be portable before.
I understand.
That stuff, so we can't do it there.
Of course not.
Like,
it makes perfect sense. I mean, a wait is a 4.5 thing.
Yes, C# 5.0.45.
Thanks.
Like, yeah.
Got it. Okay.
So that's one.
That's great stuff.
Okay.
And you're going to have a blog post where you go into your
it's
usual
pretty lengthy.
Ridiculous amounts of depth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, big things. What else?
Yes.
Performance.
Rock
and roll.
Performance. Let's talk
I saw your Facebook post and your tweets.
Yes.
You were up late, like, showing us amazing results on, like, a 64-core box?
64-core box doing, like, almost 100% utilization, like, meaning there's no
rock and roll, man.
Locks and stuff that are in the way. Of getting scalability. So
talk to us about it. What
a lot of stuff. I don't know where to start. That's the
all right, so
thing.
Let's look at what was a consistent theme in your investigation where you quickly figured out we need to optimize this.
Exactly, yeah.
That would be a good place to start.
Okay, we can talk about like maybe two or three things there that sort of stand out. And let's actually do some coding, right? You know,
right,
like,
rock and roll.
Definitely.
Whiteboard coding.
Yes. It's been too long.
I'm glad you're doing it.
Okay, so the first one I would talk about is, so there are basically different sides to it. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at Rx, really what you're building is a reactive pipeline of query operators. You're chaining operators together, right? And so if you look at that, it's really something like this. You basically have a pipeline of operators. Their messages are fed in, and they sort of flow through the pipeline, and they come out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Producer, consumer. Now, there are two possible bottlenecks in this whole picture. One is how fast you can pump things through the pipeline. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, remember some, you know, fluid dynamics courses and stuff. Like, you know, it's a little bit like that. Like, you don't want things to be wrong over here. But you also have a bottleneck. I will actually indicate it like this, using some kitchen appliances.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you call that thing again?
That is a funnel.
Funnel, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The problem can also be how fast you can drop things into the funnel. So there are two possible bottlenecks in this whole picture.
Yes.
How fast things can be sent in, and then how fast they can propagate. So what's in the camp of the things sending in, this funnel thing, is really things like subject is one big guy. Subject is a very stateful thing. You don't want to compose a pipeline using subjects. That's a common mistake people make when they start with Rx, like, oh, I need to glue two things together, let's use a subject. But, like, the lifetime of those things is kind of interesting. It's not that easy to compose those things. It's like mutual variables or mutable variables in classic languages. Like, in a functional world, you don't have those guys. So, they appear at the edges. If you look at a whole network, like, you might have subjects sitting on your edges that are, like, network endpoints to sensors and whatever. And you're just pumping data in with all next calls over there. But internally, you don't quite use subjects, unless you're multicasting stuff with publish and those kind of operators. But internally here, you're sort of in a world that's more pure.
Mm.
And there you use pipeline composition with operators. System reactive link, you do dot timeout, dot where, dot select. And like, there are no subjects in there. It's just a chain of observables that ultimately at runtime becomes a chain of observers that basically pump, you know, those pipelines between producers and consumers. So that's really what this thing is about. So subject is one of those possible bottlenecks. If you can't pump things in quickly enough over here, you have an issue.
Mm.
Secondly, a second producer is all the creation operators. Creation operators include things like range, repeat, those kind of things. Question is, how fast can those guys produce elements to feed into this pipeline? So those are two possible concerns. Actually, in one experimental, we already looked at subject to make it largely lock-free.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a subject that only has, that has zero subscribers attached to it, zero observers attached, one or two or three, like low numbers, we can actually optimize a lot of it. Like, once you get in, like, 20 observers or something, like, the performance gains are getting a little lower because we still need to serialize all the messages to those guys. But like if you have a very limited number of consumers there, and typically in a reactive network you have one guy listening to a subject, or maybe sometimes zero if nobody subscribed to it, like we don't want this thing to be blocking.
Okay.
So actually we did a lot of perfect on that guy. I won't talk about that here because that was in 1.1. But it includes things like, you know, compare and swap and compare and exchange, those kind of like instructions as opposed to classic locks.
Okay.
So quite lock-free. Over here, the creation operators, those are interesting as well. And so we'll talk about that one, and then we'll talk about the pipeline. So maybe let's focus on those two guys.
Okay.
So first, creation. Let's actually erase some stuff here. You know, the whole...
We get the funnel
picture
in.
Now, funnel yep. in, pipeline to push things through, both yep. can be bottlenecks, right?
Absolutely.
So what about the creation operators? How does an operator like, for example, say repeat work? Okay? I will implement repeat as it's done in RxT1.
Okay.
Okay. So I observable of T, repeat of T, that takes in a T value. Where do we repeat that value infinitely? You can also have one with an int comma, you know, comma int count over here. Let's ignore that one. That's the infinite generator. And basically, if you subscribe to that and you give it 42, it says 42, 42, 42, ad infinitum, like it never stops.
Hmm.
So where does it pump those values? That's a good question. So the answer is we pass into that guy an iScheduler. Okay? That's all we have today. iScheduler. S. And that's the guy that's responsible to call the onNext method. Why do we need a scheduler? Because if you subscribe to that guy, you don't want to be blocked. This thing shouldn't start spewing things to you on the same thread, because then it's not asynchronous. It's not an event stream in the way it has to be. So we need a scheduler. Everywhere we need to introduce concurrency, we use a scheduler, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's how Rx works. So how does it go internally? That's a static method. Let's ignore all of those ceremonial details. But so that really does the return of observable.create of t, that given an observer, that's a user subscribing to this, passing in the observer to signal things back on, right? If the user subscribes to this guy, it basically gives us in the subscribe method an observer, and now we can start talking to that guy. How do we talk to that guy? Well, what we need to return from this guy is an iDisposable to stop it. Subscribe takes in an iObserver, returns an iDisposable. That's the basic contract. So we need to return an iDisposable here. Where will that iDisposable come from to stop producing messages? It will come out of the scheduler.
Mm.
What we want to do is deep cancellation. If you say dispose on repeat, on the subscription to repeat, the scheduler should stop running, right? It shouldn't start continue producing 42s or something. It should stop. So we'll do a return here inside lambda, return of scheduler.schedule, and now here things can go wrong. What can I do? Let's actually do one attempt here. Actually, this is S, just to use the same color scheme. So one thing I can do inside here, and this is wrong, actually wrong should be in red, but let's do it in black today. Nothing goes to open curly, while true, call the observer on next method. Okay? Observer on next of value. Close the scheduler thing, semicolon, close the create method. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You get the idea. Like, let's close it off over here.
That's fine. We're not. Yes, the compiler is
and
very
then over here, curly. Okay, so that's what we have.
Yes.
What's the problem with that guy? If I subscribe, given the observer, we start scheduling, the scheduler runs a while through loop. How do you cancel that? If you return a disposable here, there's nothing that stops this guy. So that's the first problem. Second problem, so you can't dispose it. Second problem is this guy is not very fair. Say that the scheduler you pass in is a UI loop or an event loop that has one thread, and you schedule a piece of work on it. What does it do? It runs that piece of work. But this piece of work never stops. So other work queued up in the system can never run, because this thing is occupying the whole thread.
Mm.
Like, we want things to be interleaved. So how do we fix that in RxV1? In RxV1, we say this. We don't do a while to loop. It's bad. We actually say observer on next value, and we use a technique where I can pass in self over here, and at the bottom I can call self. Self is an action delegate. And that allows me to recurse. So basically, when the scheduler thing enters, you get a way to execute the same body of code again at the point you wish to do so. And so first we send out something on the observer, and then we call ourselves. What does that do? It's basically as if somebody from the outside did another scheduler call. So it adds it to the queue at the end of the scheduler. So what that means is, first of all, every iteration through this virtual loop now is a separate item in the scheduler queue. So an iDisposable that comes out of this thing can actually take it out of the queue. So you can cancel it. Because every time you yield control to this self thing, that's a point where we can say we're not going to run you anymore because somebody asked to stop. So any subsequent calls that you do to the scheduler will be ignored. So we can stop you, that's one thing. Secondly, this thing is fair, because if you have observable.repeat 42 and 43, and you run those two things, what happens is, like, well, 42 needs to send out 42 to its listener, right? Mm-hmm. To its observer. So it runs all the way over here, and it schedules itself to do a next iteration to the loop over here. 43 is also running there. But like when you did a subscribe to the observable repeat of 43, it queued up a piece of work that will do the first time sending out 43. Hmm. And then it will queue itself up. So really, the scheduler queue becomes something like send out 42, send out 43, send out 42, send out 43. It's sort of getting interleaved. Hmm. There's now fairness. No one can occupy the system. Unfortunately, for some of the schedulers, this is necessary. For an event loop scheduler, UI scheduler, you can't run a while loop here, because that's bad. So we have two ways to solve this today. First of all, using async. Surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. So what you can do with async now is you can actually schedule async here, actually, like this, schedule async. And now I can say async, nothing goes to, write my old good while to loop, as I always wanted to do over here. But instead of doing just a while to loop that infinitely runs this thing at the bottom, and this thing has to go down, of course, at the bottom of the while loop, I will actually say, actually this takes in a C object, which is a control object. You can play with a little bit. But what you can do now inside this while loop is you can say await C.yield. That means run the rest of this code as a separate scheduler call. So you can await that guy. So you're jumping, basically you're saying at this point, stop running this guy, somebody else can take place, and the rest of the method, you know how to run that, because I did this await thing, which is basically a handshake in the compiler-generated code with an async, you know, with a delegate call that will ultimately run the rest of the code here, like a little state machine thing. So now you can do this, yes. Like async over here, await. And your code looks as if you want to write it, but you can't monopolize the system. Of course, if you forget the await here, you're monopolizing again. So that's one way you can solve it. That's not the way we actually do things in RxV2 yet. Okay. For some places we could. But for the ones that actually, because there's an additional optimization you can do, this doesn't really add much to the optimization. It actually makes it easier for you to write these imperative style loops that still are cooperatively yielding control.
Mm-hmm.
So that's beautiful. But it doesn't really help for the case where you say, hey, I'm passing in a new thread scheduler here. What does the new thread scheduler do? When you schedule something on a new thread scheduler, it allocates a whole new thread for you. And then you can party along over here. Why do you need to do like tail recursive calls to the scheduler infrastructure to be fair with your own? There's only one guy that can see the thread. Because every scheduler call you do over here allocates a brand new thread. So in other words, we don't need to do this yield control thing. Like, we can be much more efficient. And so for the schedulers that support long-running operations, We have a little interface internally used now called iScheduler Longrunning. Actually, scheduler implementers can implement it too. And operators that say, I need to run a long-running piece of work, can now talk to scheduler long-running. They can do a type check on the scheduler, say, does this implement long-running? If so, I have a more efficient way of doing this. And what the scheduler long-running looks like is, basically, it looks like this. So say that S can be casted to scheduler long-running. It does schedule long-running. And it takes in a method that has a cancellation observer. It's not really an iObserver, it's just something that has a Boolean property on it. And now I can do in here while not cancel is this post. It's a little bit like a cancellation token, but portable across the platforms we support today. You could use cancellation token too. And in here, we're doing observer.onNext of value. So it's a while loop, but that checks whether it needs to stop running. And so when somebody disposes this repeat thing, because you do a repeat, take 5 or something, after 5 iterations, the take operator says dispose. This dispose ultimately sets this cancel thing, and this loop stops. But it's fine to run a loop on a scheduler long running, because it can guarantee you that it won't interfere with other things on the system. Only one guy that calls this guy can see the threats. So there's no problem with like long-running operations on that guy. So it's a type-check-based system where we see, like, does this thing have additional capabilities? If it knows how to do long-running operations, like a new thread schedule or the task pool with task factory options long-running, like, if it knows how to do that, we can actually go into that. So operators like repeat, range not yet at this point, I believe, but things like repeat can actually check internally to see either of the two cases. A naive scheduler, okay, or a long-running one. And it can do different things depending on the case.
Nice. So,
and that actually adds a lot of performance improvement. Like, that's really like a factor 1000x.
Wow.
For things like new thread. Because we don't have to go to... Because if you do this self-call over here, mm-hmm, really what it needs to do is, like, internally that guy creates a new UI scheduler call, which creates a little anonymous object to pass the state to, that returns an iDisposable to cancel that guy. Need to throw away the current disposable, assign the new one. Mm. Like a lot of object allocations just to sort of be able to cancel something that's infinite anyway, and that we can simply stop by looking at this dispose thing. So like, we still need to do that for UI loops and all of those things. Mm-hmm. But for those efficient schedulers, you don't want to sacrifice the fairness of the system or the ability to be fair in certain cases. Don't want to sacrifice that because, well, you might have one scheduler that can't guarantee fairness and you need to do this cooperative yielding. Mm. So here you can say, like, in case there is an optimal way of doing it, we can do it. And we could have chosen to say, like, if the scheduler is new thread, we do this. If it's task pool, do that. But, like, new thread doesn't even live in the portable subset. So we need to have an interface check as opposed to knowing of certain schedulers. It also means that other people can implement long-running schedulers themselves. If you do a long-running scheduler for something that can't guarantee fairness, you're screwing up Rx. Like, you know, then somebody can schedule on you and our operators don't know any better, right?
Yeah.
So it's an open world, people can implement it, and they should know the implications of this guy. So it's an advanced interface, but at the same time, there's only like one guy writing schedulers for a million Rx users. Like,
sure.
There are not that many schedulers in the world.
Yes. The one that comes out of the box is all you need for the
exactly
person.
Yes, and we've added the ones for the MRT thread pool and
nice,
the Metro UI message loop and those kind of things. So, like, you might have other ones for high performance compute scenarios or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can totally do that and implement them using this technique.
Beautiful.
So that's that operator. Let's now talk about the second one.
Okay.
Which is, so there are some other scheduler facilities that we can check for using a cast. I won't talk about all of those, they will all be in the blog post that will appear later this week. But like another thing we check for sometimes is whether a scheduler has the ability to give me a stopwatch.
Hmm.
Stopwatch is something that just increases time. It can never skip back or anything.
Okay.
So it should be a monotonically increasing counter. And so we use that for things like delay, to basically look at running time as opposed to always compare ourselves to the current system clock time. Because if we do daytime offset.utc now, it turned out like if you were doing a large delay operation, like about 50% of our heap were daylight saving objects or something. Because UTC now needs to compute those things, and the daylight saving doesn't really change like every once a millisecond, right? So there could be some caching, and you know the framework team is actually looking into optimizing that code part. But like in the first place, us calling UTC now every millisecond for a delay operation or something doesn't really make sense. So if your scheduler and every local scheduler supports that, like every scheduler running on the local machine implements this stopwatch facility, we can do a better job. We can just walk up to a stopwatch and compare the next time we run to where the stopwatch is. If we are scheduled too early, we have to schedule us back in the time that's the distance between the stopwatch and the time we have to run.
Okay.
As opposed to doing daytime subtractions, we do time span subtractions. So we could also do environment tick count or something like that, which has the same properties, but tick count doesn't really correspond to real time in a very nice way. You need 100 nanosecond conversions and a lot of those things. So we say like stopwatch is the base primitive. That makes a lot of sense. So that's another place where we do some platform specific checks.
I see.
And schedulers can just implement that thing, and operators just get a lot bigger, or a lot more efficient. Can put much more volumes of data based on that. But so another operator, let's actually write a very naive select operator, okay?
Okay.
And that will, so this, what we talked about, the repeat thing, is really a bottleneck for the producer, for the funnel. This is a bottleneck for the pipeline. We'll talk about that one now. So this thing returns an iObservable of R, takes in an iObservable of T, which I will call axis, and it takes in a func from T to R, which I will call f.
Okay?
That's select, right? Give me t's, a function for t to r, I give you back r's. Perfect. So how does that work? You do return create of r, given an observer, just the same thing as before, really. And in here, we need to return a disposable to stop this whole thing. Where can we get a disposable from? We have an iObservable. We need to do something with this function. We better subscribe to axis at some point, right? And that returns an iDisposable. So that's great. We do axis.subscribe, like this. And now we have to handle onNext on error on completed. OnNext, given an x, has to run some code that runs f and then calls observer onNext with the result of calling f. Like, given a product and a product to price selector function, I have to call that function to single back the price of the product, right? Very simple. So what we do here is like something like try catch error, well, exception error, pretended JavaScript. And so what I'm doing in here is, you know, var result equals f of x, right? Okay, so what we're doing here is we're doing a try catch around calling the function, right? And so when this function throws, we need to talk to our observer to say something went wrong. So we need to say observer on error of the error, and then we return over here from this lambda expression. Otherwise, if we reach the end of this code, we have the result. We didn't throw an exception from this guy. And so what we're going to do is we're going to do observer on next of the result, like this. And so now when a message comes in, we run to this selector function. If it throws, we propagate the error message over here, the exception object. If it doesn't throw, we actually reach the end of the time block, and we pump the result to the observer. Now, we still haven't handled the error case and the completed case. Well, those are pretty simple as well. You know, for the error case, we just pass in the onError delegate. And for the exception, or for the completion case, we do observer.onCompleted. Like this. And so, the subscribe call now has three things. It has a custom handwritten on next method that does transformation using f over here. and errors and completion messages simply burst through. So if you subscribe to this guy and the source throws an exception, propagates an exception, it just flows through to the receiver, the observer of R. So that's how that works. Now, there are two things in here that actually make the performance problematic. And so, first of all, when you look at this create operator, right, the observer that you get over here, you may ask the question, like, is that really the observer that the user gave him? Is that, am I directly talking to my consumer? Because if somebody does, like, access.select, x goes to f of x, could just write f here, and then I do a subscribe with an observer, is this thing, the dot, 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 exactly the same thing as what I get here? And the answer is no. We have that observer with some additional behavior to ensure the message gamma of Rx. And so this observer that you have here is really an auto-detach observer, meaning that if inside the body at some point we say on error, what that guy will do is it will propagate the error message all the way to the handler, so upstream or downstream, like all the way to the consumer, but it will also stop the subscription to access internally, so it will start tearing down the pipeline. So it does all of that stuff simply by wrapping the observer. If the observer sees an error or a completion message coming by, it will actually cancel the subscription to the existing sources. And it does that using some tricks with, like, single assignment disposables, those kind of things, inside Rx. So that's the first thing. The second thing that's interesting for from a performance point of view is this guy, the subscribe method. What does a subscribe method look like? This is a subscribe that takes in three functions: on next, on error, on completed. How do we make it into an observer? Is it as simple as wrapping those three delegates into an observer of T? The answer is unfortunately not. We do some additional stuff over there as well, in a way that if an error is received or a completion message is actually happening, we can shut off further messages from the source coming in. So this enforces that if X over here, this guy, X, if it actually is a well-behaved observable, something like this, everything goes according to plan. Like, we get it on next call, we get it on next call, on next call, on completed call. But if it's the rogue observer, meaning it's an observable, I mean, that, for example, sends a message after it has told us that it's completed, we could be messing up state internally. So what this subscribe guy does is, those three lambdas over here that are passed in are protected against rogue observables, meaning that if this guy signals uncompleted, we call this function over here. At that point, before calling that function, we set a little flag internally that says, if this source in the future sends me a message, I will not send it into the onNext because the operator doesn't expect that. The operator doesn't expect onNext messages after it has seen uncompleted. And so, those two assumptions, the assumption that you can simply say on error or uncompleted inside the body, causing automatic disposing of the subscriptions, makes it easier to write the code. Secondly, this subscribe call with the triad of lambda expressions for onNext, on error, uncompleted, with this, you know, behavior that you see over here, protects us against rogue implementations of observables being passed in. And so both of those things that we have here really add some performance overhead. Welcome back, Charles.
Thank you, man. So I had a coughing fit, so people know. I mean, but continue.
Okay, yes. So what I was just explaining is that using create and subscribe, those two guys add a lot of wrapping to the observer and the, you know, the handlers that are passed to subscribe. And that's to do two things. First of all, to protect against sources like X's over here that are ill-behaved, meaning they don't obey to the message camera.
Okay.
And secondly, the observer that's passed in here has auto-detach behavior, which means that if inside the implementation at some point we call on error, we don't have to do resource cleanup ourselves. As this guy sees an on error message coming through, it automatically disposes of the subscription that's sitting inside. So that's an automatic, like, that's a safety net kind of thing. But that adds a lot of stuff. And if you actually look at call stacks in Rx, people have historically said, I can't read your call stacks. That's kind of a common complaint. Like, this had a breakpoint over here, right? Access.select, and say that access is the range operator or something. Range 0 through 10. And then I do x goes to some code over here, and I set a breakpoint. Okay? I'm setting a breakpoint right over here. Okay? So there's my breakpoint, and I hit F5. This breakpoint hits at some point, and now you look at the call stack. How does the call stack look like? I can even not completely try to sketch it.
I bet you don't even know, man.
Yeah, it's,
no, I'm kidding.
Because it's gone in V2. But so at the bottom, you will see something like the trapped bool or something.
Okay.
On top of that, you will see this range operator with a lot of scheduler recursive invocations. That's what we talked about before. We talked about those guys need to ensure fairness. So if you're running on a scheduler that's not long running, the call stack will look different than if you're running on a long running scheduler. But so, say that you're not long running, you will see lots of invoke rec things over here. Invoke recursive. That's the recursive scheduling stuff. So that easily accounts for like 10 or so, maybe 5 to 10 stack frames. And the trapped bool by itself has a lot of stack frames as well. Okay? On top of that, you will see range trying to send out an onNext message to select. But select is implemented like this. It subscribes to range using this triad of things, you know, using three lambdas, this lambda, that lambda. That adds some safety to it with, you know, an anonymous observer and all of that kind of stuff. That accounts for two stack frames to get the message from range out to my code over here, to the inner lambda. Two stack frames. Then this lambda runs. This is really my select method, right? Select is running. On the top here was range producing a message. So range was sending out 0, went through two stack frames, ending up in select. Now select wants to talk to the observer here, doing observer on next. But that's an auto-detach observer. That adds a lot of wrapping as well. So it does two more calls to get out here. And then ultimately we end up in a subscribe call, which is a subscribe using a lambda. That by itself adds two stack frames. And so here we are in our breakpoint. Wow. So a lot of stuff here, a lot of stuff there. So that's a lot of, that's a pretty significant path length. And it turns out the JIT is pretty good at actually inlining some of those guys. But some of those are also virtuals and are non-trivial pieces of code that do an interlocked operation to shut things off and all of that kind of stuff. Now it turns out if we make a few more assumptions about Rx, that we can optimize this a lot. First of all, we're doing access.subscribe on this thing to protect against rogue observables.
Rogue observables
that don't obey to the message camera. So do we really have to protect against that in a very consistent, aggressive way? That's one of the questions. The answer is we can apply some of those measures internally in the operators. Leads to a little bit more code in the operators, you know, a little more disciplined way of writing the operators. But if you also assume a closed-world model, where the ways that you build observables is either through operators, which are per definition well-behaved, because we test them not to ever have rogue behavior. If you use observable.create, you can do all sorts of crazy things in here. We ensure that you can't go wrong. Like if you tell us to do an onNext after an onError, we'll ignore your onNext call. You can write the worst code in this handler, like you can do all sorts of things. We make sure that your sequence looks right. So we will eat certain messages at the end that aren't supposed to be there.
Okay.
In the first place, your operator is implemented in the wrong way. But you know, we protect against that in observable.create. If you inherit from observable base of T, same thing. We also make sure that you can't go wrong in terms of the grammar. So if sources, the well-blessed sources that you can create are okay, and operators take the okay world to a new okay world, then an inductive argument says that everything you do to Rx is okay. So we don't need to protect against those things all the way in every single operator internally. Only on the edges of the network we need to make sure that no bad things can flow in. But internally, if select is talking to where to take, where can know that select never does something wrong. so it can operate under certain assumptions. Mm. So that's the first thing. That actually gets rid of those two spec frames over here altogether.
Nice.
Secondly, the spec frames to go out, this auto-detach behavior, we can get rid of as well. The only thing is, when we do observer on error over here, we need to clean up after ourselves. So whenever we do a terminal message, we have to do dispose stuff manually, not rely on a wrapper here to do that. That's actually worth it, because this wrapper influences every onNext message. So for an infinite stream, billions of messages a second, this adds overhead. Whereas the overhead is purely there to protect against the one and only case, or the two cases, where you sent an on-error or on-completed. So it's there to protect against two things. In a sea of infinite streams, those two things are irrelevant, right? We can still make sure the thing does the right thing by doing manual disposing of resources internally in the right spots. So it, again, you have to write tags in a more disciplined way, and we have a whole slew of unit tests that check that disposing is happening at the right time. So we can safely start, you know, making those things like more fine-grained control. And then we can get rid of this auto-detach thing on top of that guy, getting rid of those two stack frames as well. And so now, if you look at an Rx call stack, you do select, where, range, take. In the past, it was 5 per operator. So you had like, I don't know how many operators I gave you, but like 20 stack frames. Now you see 4. Where goes into select, goes into take.
Great.
Comes from range. And so the call stack is nice. You can look at, you know, you can debug it easily. And that actually adds a lot of performance improvement, because we don't have to do checks in the auto-detach guy. When we have to do some auto-detach behavior in a certain case, we do an interlocked operation to do that, so more efficiently as well.
Great.
You're basically talking to the mute observer at that point. And so that adds like to the pipeline that's on the average effect of 4x. Depends on machine configuration or like architecture, whatever. But like 3 to 4 or maybe 3 to 5 in certain cases.
But as you said, it also adds to productivity, the other
part. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Right? Because you know, not everybody is you. So give us call stacks we can actually understand and
exactly.
Debug rapidly,
yes. Yeah.
Efficiently.
Mm-hmm. You can see why you ended up in a certain operator.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Certain callback. And so extending on that, we did some other stuff as well. Like, for example, operators that were implemented in terms of other operators, we reduced those significantly. And just to draw one, just like one little sketch here of a piece of code, the way that buffer was implemented was in terms of window. Because windows are, like if you do a window, like say I do a window of messages, let's write some messages first, right? And I do a window, non-overlapping windows of 2 seconds or something. What really happens is when you, so this is the result stream, right? When I subscribe to the result stream, we tell you, here's a new window. And we run that window for 2 seconds, meaning those messages arrive in your window, okay? After 2 seconds, we give you a new inner stream for 2 seconds that gives you those two messages. Say that there were 3 messages in that case, okay? Then this window does uncompleted, and you get a new window thrown at you. And they can be overlapping, those windows, in certain cases. Like if you actually say, please window me for 5 seconds and skip 1 second at a time, you get overlapping windows with overlap of 4 seconds, right?
Okay.
Second one to 5, 2 to 6, and so on. So that's how window works. Now, window came out of, I'm actually just writing up the part in the blog post explaining the history of window. But first we had buffer. Buffer is not like this. It's somehow similar, but what buffer does is, if you say, I want to buffer things with durations of 2, what I want to get back is an iObservable of iList. Not an iObservable of iObservables, not those inner streams. I want to get, at the end of the 2 seconds, I want to get a message here, a message here, and a message here, that includes the things in the list that you've seen in the last 2 seconds. So it's something like this. You get a list thrown at you here with 3 bullet points, and here with 2 bullet points at this point. So you get little lists at the end of the windows. Windows start at the beginning of the interval, windows at the end, buffers at the end send things out. So that's how window and buffer relate. So first we only had buffer. Then we said, wait, one of the values of Rx is higher order streams, a stream of streams. We can do that. That's beautiful. That's where the expressiveness comes in. So we said we can do window. And then we said, wait, we have buffer with count, with overloads, two overloads. Buffer with time, with four overloads, with the skip and non-skip, the schedules and no schedule. We have buffer with time or count, two overloads. That's eight overloads to buffer. We also generalized it with opening and closing selectors. That's 10 overloads in total. And now we're going to add window, yet another 10. The logic inside is sort of the same. Like, can't we use composition to make this work? And we said, we can do buffer in terms of window. Get rid of the buffer code altogether and do it in terms of window. Mm. So we said, like, you know, window is, or buffer is really the same as this. Buffer of axis with a certain count, C, is implemented as, so I'm using some pseudocode here, axis.window with that count. Now I have an iObservable of iObservables. How do I take those inner streams into lists? That's where we actually, by doing buffer in terms of window, we gain some other things. Mm. That's the beauty also of composition. Sometimes you discover new things. Like you're saying, oh, I'm going to use this little piece sitting on the ground here. You take up the rock and then you see, oh, underneath there's something else that I can do. So given this iObservable of iObservables of the inner streams, I need to turn them into lists. And originally we said, you can do something like select of the window goes to window.toEnumerable.toList. Mm-hmm. Right? That blocks the whole thing, that locks our X. Why? Because a message comes through to this window thing, comes in here, we say there's a new window for you, and now while that call is going out of X in the onNext handler, you're saying toEnumerable.toList. ToList has to wait till the end of the current window. So you're waiting for the end of the window, but you're stalling the pipeline from producing something else. Hmm. So like it can never produce anything anymore, and you're waiting for things to be produced. So you're deadlocked. Like, so that doesn't work. So we actually had to invent a new operator, a non-blocking toList operator that takes an iObservable of T to an iObservable of iList of T, which is an asynchronous toList, an aggregate operator. We didn't have that
before. ToList async.
ToList async, exactly. Sort of similar. ToList async would return a task of, you know, something. But it's similar in respect. You can think of it as ToList async. So we said, like, now we can do something like window goes to window.toList. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now I have an iObservable of iObservables turned into an iObservable of, now I have to think, the inner iObservable is turned into an iObservable of iList. So now I have an iObservable of iList. Okay, that works. Composition to the rescue. How do I flatten that? Because I want an iObservable of iList back. I have one iObservable too much. Mm. We have a merge operator for that.
Ah.
Merge person. Okay, that flattens it. On task of T, they have something like unwrap or flatten or something as well. Okay. For task of T, to make it a task of T, if you have too much wrapping. So that's merge. In fact, those two, select followed by a merge, is the same as a select many. So you can actually implement it as a select many. Okay? Now you can still have buffers at the end that are empty. Why? Because, like, say that you're at the end of the stream, and a new window was created over here. Okay? And there are no messages in here. A new window is sent out at the beginning. The buffer actually buffers everything up and makes an iList at the end to send it out. Mm. But that there was nothing in here, so you're sending out an empty iList because nothing happened at the end. So we don't want that. Our original buffer didn't give you empty buffers at the end. So we also need to do a where here, where we say where lst goes to lst.count is larger than zero. Okay, so that's how you do that thing. So we have done buffer in terms of window select many and where. How select many done? I already had it on the whiteboard before. Select many is a select followed by a merge. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 operators here. How's toList done? ToList is an aggregate. It's an aggregate with an iList as the state to accumulate. So yet another one here. How does window work? Window allocates subjects internally. So now if you're in this call stack, like, times four, right? For the number five, actually, for per frame, one frame, two frames, three frames, four frames, five frames. This thing doesn't really influence it because it's inlet, guys.
Okay.
That's like 25 frames. And actually what's happening is for all of the windows you're allocating a subject, okay, it then has to be turned into a list.
Hmm.
That's two object allocations per buffer. Originally we only needed one.
Hmm.
So actually we've re-implemented this buffer thing in a native way. And we didn't do that before. Why didn't we do that before? Well, for correctness. Like, buffer and window had strikingly similar code with the same subtleties of edge cases. Like, what to do on the boundary of a window? Like, can we lose messages? No, shouldn't we lose messages? Maybe. Like, you know, we had to figure that out quite a bit. And so window was the obvious guy to be, like, the more general one. And we could distill buffer out of it. And that also helps with test coverage and all of those things. Like, to really beat the hell out of it, you don't want to have two separate implementations. You can prove window to be correct by running all the existing buffer tests, which are now based on window. So, like, that was the right thing to do for RxV1.
Okay.
To ship as the queues, you know, you want to get the functionality right. Like, if the correctness is not there, you shouldn't start talking about the performance, right? So now we did the work of inlining those things much more aggressively. If you now look at a call stack, one stack frame, you get a new buffer, you see buffer sitting there. In the past, you saw 25 things that you never saw before. You wrote buffer and you get aware with a merge on a select on the subject, you don't even see the window because you're talking to a subject allocated inside the window. So your call stack was totally unreasonable.
Sure.
Now it's totally readable, you will see buffer over there. So that's another technique we used. That's limiting the number of compositions, like select many and select and merge. Like select many by itself is sort of a clone of merge, but with some additional optimizations. It doesn't need that selecting in front of it. Like, we can inline those things, and then we get better performance, actually. Which means, of course, if there is a bug in one of the two, we also need to fix it in the other one. So it adds more maintenance burden, but, you know, that's stuff that we can take care of.
Sure.
You know, consumers never have to care about that.
Great.
And, you know, many other things, actually.
Sure.
Including allocations, for example. Like, materialize is very useful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can say, I have a stream of things. Okay. And say that I have two streams, and I want to do a binary operator between them, like take until. X is dot take until Y is. How do you implement that operator internally? Well, you need to listen to the three messages on X, the three messages on Y. That's six callbacks that you have to write. And then you are talking to the observer in both, but they can be concurrent. X and Y can run on different threads. So when you talk to the outgoing observer, one of the message grammar things is you can't have two calls to the observer at the same time. They have to be serialized. Because otherwise you get into, like, everyone needs to put a lock around things because multiple messages can come in at the same time. That wouldn't be scalable.
Mm-hmm.
So we say, like, we will make sure that we actually serialize messages correctly. So you need six event handlers. You need some way of synchronizing talking to the observer. And it gets out of hand quickly. So what we said for take until and all those binary operators, let's actually write a single combiner function that says x's.combine y's, and then what you get back in there is what we call a binary observer. That allows you to look at both channels in a very interesting way.
Hmm.
What you get back is notifications of either left or right. Either is a type that you can look at. Is it left or is it right? So you can do if checks, as opposed to writing code in six different places.
Nice.
But internally, the either ones don't contain the values, they contain notifications.
Hmm.
It's either of notification of left, comma, notification of right. What's a notification? It's a heap allocated object. What's an either? It's a heap allocated object. So something like access.takeUntilNever had to materialize and either all of the objects in access simply because it's more convenient inside the implementation of the operator to do if checks as opposed to write six callbacks. And that's nice for, you know, getting things done and making sure they're correct and all of those things, like put a sledgehammer on it and the boundaries say, like, we're taking a big lock, we're doing allocations of eaters and notifications, and we can just do an if check and things are much more easy to write and provably correct. But that's a lot of cost. And actually, if you look at the graph of take until in performance monitor, and look, time spent in GC for take until never, it's around 10%.
Okay.
Time purely spent in creating notification objects, throwing them away. Notification objects, throwing them away.
Inefficient.
So now it's flat at zero. Nice. No allocations whatsoever for those guys.
Excellent.
So, like, materialize is forbidden internally in the code now. Mm. Like, so, because that adds a lot of overhead. Same for delay. Delay used to have a queue of notifications. Now it has a queue of these. Actually, it has a concurrent queue from the TPL of these, reducing locking as well. But so for delay, for example, we had the embarrassing thing, but it's only for large volume streams. Like if you do UI stuff, the user can't type that fast. Even if you do network events, the network can't give you stuff that fast.
Mm.
If you do large scale event processing, millions of messages a second, like if you delay, if you can send 1 million messages in a second, say it takes like this, right? That's access. 0 seconds. 1 second. And say you can send for some reason from some other operator, you can get 1 million messages in 0.9 seconds. Okay? Now you want to delay that with 1 second. What do you expect if you delay that with 1 second? You expect the messages to come in from 1 second to 1.9 seconds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now all the overhead that was added to the queuing, the dequeuing, the locking, all of that stuff, ended up that, like, if you delayed this large volume for 1 second, you know, it could easily take 2.5 seconds to get last messages. So things got spread out in time. It's not a problem if you only send, like, one half of those things. And for UI events, you know, maybe in 1 second you can do 5 things or something. I don't know how fast people can type or even move the mouse that's stalled in Win32K.Scissor or whatever. Like, you don't get that many events if you move really fast. Like, it sort of tops certain messages before they reach your user mode code. But the thing is, like, if you really do those heavy streams, then you run into those problems. That's no longer the case in RxV2. Actually, it can get out that many messages if a delay of 1 second.
Great.
So, a lot of performance improvements.
Well, great work, Bart.
Mm-hmm.
You've been very, very busy, man.
It's been quite busy 3 months, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see. I mean, I've been covering RX since you guys invented it.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are at 2.0. I mean, time just absolutely flies by.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's modernized a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, I think for large-scale stream insight kind of stuff,
mm-hmm. yes,
which is, you know, orthogonal to this, but the point is where you're dealing with just a huge pipe
mm-hmm.
and a lot of stuff coming through
it. Yeah.
You can scale to that reasonably and efficiently.
Mm-hmm. And it's a better together story. That's one of the things you're working on mm-hmm. intensively with the Stream Insight folks. It's like, how do you combine the power of RX with the power of Stream Insight? And
sure.
Historically, they've actually had their adaptive model based on my observable of T.
Mm.
So that means, like, if you can do the thing that I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, like those guys that take an Ike observable, take the expression tree and compile it into a bytecode that runs on a little device. You can push part of your query using RX expressiveness onto little devices, onto the edges of your network. Like, you know, in the field you have thousands of sensors that monitor temperature or whatever in, like, some, you know, tree growth facility or whatever, like, or in a garden center or whatever, like the power grid, smart grids, all of those things. Like, you can run RX very efficiently at the boundaries of the network. You can also run it in the cloud. But then, like, you know, composing that with facilities like running a service, high availability, all the things that certain people can add to that, that's a nice, you know, better together thing.
Absolutely, man. Well, hey, people read the blog post.
Yes.
And I'm sure that they have probably paused and are replaying this as well.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you for your time, as always, Bart.
It's my pleasure.
Great work, man.
And thanks for covering us on Channel
Sure.
9
well, congratulations on V2, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's big.
It's big, yes.
Rock and roll. Yeah. Cheers.
See you.